From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with former hostage Terry Anderson about his $100 million lawsuit against the Iranian government. He's charging the government with sponsoring the group that held him hostage in Lebanon for close to 7 years. We'll talk about his suit and about his long recovery from captivity. Also, we remember jazz singer Joe Williams. The former singer with the Count Basie Band died yesterday. His best-known recordings included Every Day I Have the Blues and All Right, Okay, You Win. We'll remember him with an excerpt of a 1989 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry Anderson is suing the government of Iran for $100 million in damages. He's accusing the Iranian government of sponsoring the Hezbollah, the Islamic fundamentalist group that kidnapped him in Beirut and held him hostage for nearly 7 years. Anderson spent much of that time blindfolded and chained to a wall. He was held longer than any other American hostage in Lebanon. Anderson was the Associated Press Middle East correspondent when he was kidnapped on March 16, 1985. In a few minutes, we'll talk with him about his lawsuit and about his life today. But first, let's listen back to an interview about his captivity that we recorded in 1993 after the publication of his memoir, Den of Lions. He told me that each of the hostages he was held with had one thing that most challenged their manhood. For Anderson, it related to the treatment of his fellow hostage, Brian Keenan.
The worst thing was not reacting, not leaping to the defense of Brian when he was beaten, chained and taped and beaten beside me. I was chained also. There isn't anything I really could have done. And we knew by then that the best reaction when they went into these rages, which they did from time to time, was just to curl up and wait it out. Because if you defied them, they just went further over the wall and you could get seriously hurt. Whereas if you offered no resistance, they would eventually stop. But to lie there and listen to a close friend and companion being beaten while you do nothing, even if you know it's the right thing to do, is a pretty disgusting, humiliating experience.
Did you watch or did you look away?
I was blindfolded.
Oh, sure.
You couldn't watch. But you could hear.
Did you say anything? You said nothing.
Not during the beating. Afterward, yeah. We went on a hunger strike, all of us. Demanded that they remove the guard who did the beating.
Did they care that you were on a hunger strike?
Oh, sure.
Why?
They didn't want us to get sick and die. Were valuable to them.
Uh-huh.
It worked for a while. After a while, you know, the third or fourth time we did it, then didn't work all that well. But it always bothered them enough so that we could get the attention of some leader or some chief, which was the point, of course.
Terry, I want to ask you, when during the 7 years that you were held hostage, how much of that time were you chained to the wall?
We were chained the first 4.5 months. And then we were put in a place where they did not keep us on a chain. They merely kept locks on the doors. There were several of us in the room for a year. Then we went to another basement cell where the cells were only 6 feet square and 6 feet high, so we hardly needed a chain. We were put on chains again in January 1987, when Terry Waite was kidnapped. And we remained chained from January of 1987 until December of 1991. So
there were 4 years in a row,
yeah,
of being chained.
We were never off the chain, except to go to the bathroom.
Did you have your choice of which leg was chained?
Yeah, it depended. You sometimes would have the choice of whether your ankle was chained or whether your wrist was chained, you know, which foot you'd put it on. Sometimes you wouldn't, depended on where we were.
What? How would you choose?
Oh, ankle's better than wrist, no problem.
Why is the ankle better?
Well, because you can stand up, you can take 2 paces in each direction if it's a 5-foot chain. If it's on your wrist, then you can't walk and you can't stand up. They chained my wrist there for 1.5 years with Tom. And that was 1.5 years you couldn't stand up.
Wow. What happened to your legs during that period?
I got pretty weak. I got fat, actually, because they were giving us a lot of rice and stuff. And I put on weight.
That must have felt really odd, gaining weight.
It felt very odd. We didn't have very much to do except eat whatever they gave us.
So what'd you do for your legs when you were able to walk again?
Well, we went to another prison where they gave us a 30-minute of exercise each morning. And I would jog back and forth across the room. And then when they put us back on the chain, I did a lot of exercises then to try to get my strength back. I got some of it back, but I was still awfully weak when I was released.
What were the times when you were most afraid of losing your sanity?
Oh, there were a few times when I thought I was going to lose it. There was a time when I began to lose it and began beating my head against the wall. Beat it bloody, and they had to pull me down and chain me up again. There were one or two others. There was a time in solitary confinement for a while, in a very bad place, no lights, and no books or anything in the cell, when I thought I was going to lose it. I was going crazy, but it ended, and I managed to get through. That's a strange thing, you know. I keep coming back to this. Terry Waite spent 3.5 years in solitary confinement with no other input, no books, nothing, no contact with anybody, nothing to think about, only his head. And when he joined us, he was sane. I spent less than a year in solitary confinement altogether, and it nearly destroyed me. And different things affect men differently.
Terry Anderson, recorded in 1993. Now Anderson is suing the government of Iran for $100 million in damages, accusing the government of sponsoring his captors, the Hezbollah. I asked Anderson to describe the American law that is enabling him to sue Iran.
Well, I don't know the exact provisions. You'd have to talk with my lawyer. But basically, Congress passed a law that allows individuals to sue governments that sponsor terrorism if those individuals were damaged in some fashion by terrorist acts. The law provides for a waiver that the president can execute in individual cases where he thinks that foreign policy might be adversely affected. President Clinton, unfortunately, has applied it in a blanket fashion, not in individual fashion, to simply block cooperation with all lawsuits against Iran and pretty much other nations, too. The law is intended to make terrorism expensive. It's not there to make victims rich. It's there to counter the reason why governments engage in terrorism, because it's cheap. It's a cheap way to wage war. But if you can make them pay enough, you can discourage them from doing it. And I think that's a pretty good purpose.
I want to play you an excerpt of an interview that we recorded with you in 1993. And this was after the publication of a book that you'd co-authored with your wife, Madeline Basile. And you had told me in this interview that you were determined to forgive your captors. And here's what you had to say.
It's something that you work on fairly often every time you think about it. And probably will go on for a long time. But it's something that we have to do for two reasons. We're Christians, and we're required to, and because I'm not going to let it affect my life. If I stay angry, if I stay bitter over what happened, it's not going to hurt them. It's only going to hurt me and the people around me. I have a very good life right now. I'm very happy right now. I don't want that to be harmed in any way.
So, Terry Anderson, that was recorded in 1993. Have you changed your mind about forgiving your captors?
No, not at all. I've continued to work on it. It is still something that I do whenever I can, whenever I think about it. It's a long road. It's a process. And I think I've made considerable progress in understanding just what it's about. What does forgiveness mean? What is that supposed to mean? It means that I'm not angry. It means that I don't hate them, that I'm not bitter. Does it mean that I don't think they should be held responsible for what they did? No, I don't think so. I have been back to Lebanon twice. I have interviewed for a CNN documentary the Secretary General and other high officials of Hezbollah, the Party of God, the people who held me captive. I asked them what they thought of the kidnapping today. They said then that they wouldn't say it was wrong. It was just something that happened. And that was okay, because part of that was to to really know. You know, you can say you forgive them and you don't really know until you look them in the face. And I did. I looked them in the face and I talked to them and I'm not angry at them and I am trying to forgive them. There's still a long way to go. I'm not doing this because I'm angry at Iran. I'm doing this because I think at this particular point, where a number of circumstances have come together, the new law, a couple of successful suits, Iran is turning to the world again, becoming more moderate and seemingly interested in rejoining the community of nations. And I think that before they do that, they need to acknowledge what they've done. They can't simply shrug their shoulders and say, we never did anything wrong, and expect to be embraced as part of the free world. They can't do that. I'm not going to let them do that. Neither are any of the other people who have been harmed by those acts.
My guest is Terry Anderson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry Anderson. He's suing the government of Iran, accusing it of sponsoring the Islamic extremists who held him hostage in Lebanon for nearly 7 years. You're suing for $100 million in damages. How important is getting the money?
Well, it better not be important because it's certainly not going to happen in the near future. I don't expect to get much in the way of money, if anything. Getting the judgment will be relatively easy, a matter of a few months, both because the evidence is overwhelming and because the Iranians won't defend. They have never gone into court to defend themselves. After that comes the hard part. Then the argument changes to, instead of fighting with Iran, I'll be fighting with the U.S. government, because the Clinton administration is refusing to assist in these lawsuits. They're refusing to help identify Iranian assets and to attach them. And that's what the law says they should do. President Clinton has waived that provision of the law. He has exempted his people in the State Department and elsewhere from helping us find and attach Iranian assets. He does that because he doesn't want his foreign policy to be complicated. He thinks that it might make it more difficult for Iran to open up. I can understand it. I don't agree with it. I think he's wrong. And much of the effort that we will be engaged in, all of us, will be to persuade him that he's wrong, to change his policy, to help us find those assets and attach them, to force Iran to accept what they've done.
What impact do you think this lawsuit is going to have on you psychologically and emotionally? I imagine in preparing for the lawsuit, you have to revisit the time that you were held hostage, and then you'll have to testify about it, so you'll have to, relive the whole experience in some ways again.
I think we'll do all right. It'll be all three of us, It'll be my wife and my daughter as well. We've worked hard on putting that period, the events of those years, in perspective, in the proper place. It's not that we've forgotten them or covered them up. They're still there. They're still in our minds all the time. But we've been trying very hard to fit them in place with everything else we have in our lives. And I think we've successfully done that. And as I said, I think that's one of the reasons we're able to do this now, because we've healed enough so that going back to that period won't be as traumatic and difficult as it might have been.
Well, what kind of work are you doing now?
I teach journalism at the Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University, and I enjoy that a lot. This is a beautiful part of the country in southeast Ohio, and it's a good school. I do some writing and some speaking still on various subjects, and I have a couple of projects. I'm vice chairman of the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is an international group that monitors attacks on the press around the world and tries to get journalists out of jail. And that's a delight for me. Not so long ago, I went to Turkey and I persuaded the Turkish government, along with Peter Arnett and some other people from the committee, to release half a dozen editors that they had put in jail for writing about the war in southeast Turkey. And they actually did. They released them. We went to see them in prison and told them that they were going to be released. And then we brought their leader to New York. And I can remember I had seen him in jail in European Turkey, in a rural jail. And the next time I saw him was in the Rainbow Room in New York. And I bought him a bottle of champagne and we spent the night talking. And that's really a wonderful feeling. I feel very strongly about journalism. I'm quite passionate about it. And I admire very much those people in other countries who practice journalism in the face of not just threats, but real danger from their own government of kidnapping and beating and torture and murder. And whenever I can do anything to help them, I do it. I mean, we've gotten people out of jail all around the world simply with pressure and negotiation and persuasion. That's good work.
When you were covering the Middle East for the Associated Press and you were stationed in Beirut, did you not think of yourself as taking risks then?
Of course I did. We took risks all the time, in Beirut especially, but also in Africa and Asia before that. It's a risky profession. I was pretty good at it. I was pretty good at judging the risks and getting the story without getting anybody hurt for most of the time. In 1985, I made a mistake. I made a couple of mistakes. I was too arrogant. I'd been doing it for too long. I had been too successful, and therefore I felt invulnerable. We knew it was dangerous. My wife and I had a long discussion / argument the night before I was kidnapped about how dangerous it was getting in Beirut. And I remember I told her, I'm not leaving until they come through the windows. And she said, Terry, they don't come through the windows. They didn't. They got me on the street. I'm not convinced there was much I could have done about that except leave. And I wasn't ready to leave. I thought what I was doing was important. Obviously, I was wrong. I should have left.
Do you feel like you were particularly in the wrong place on the day you were kidnapped?
Oh, I was just oblivious to what was going on. They tried to kidnap me the day before, on the Friday. They tried to drive my car off the road, and I got away from them. And then I just, the next day, I went out and played tennis, which is stupid. I just wasn't paying enough attention to my own security. It's a well-known syndrome, you know. I'm just here to watch. I'm not really part of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, suddenly you discover you are part of it, as far as they're concerned.
You know, in reference to the work that you're doing trying to free journalists who have been arrested, I think sometimes American or other Western journalists are arrested by certain governments who assume that the journalists are really spies or are somehow connected to intelligence agencies. And I'm wondering, when you read, for instance, that there really were spies posing as UN weapons inspectors during the UN weapons inspections of Iraq, does that make you fear that governments will feel more justified in their suspicions of journalists?
Absolutely. I thought that was just totally inexcusable. It was the CIA cowboys again. I testified before two Senate committees against a proposal to legalize or codify what's called the director's exemption, the director of the CIA. You may remember the head of the CIA a couple of years ago actually came out in public and said that while they had agreed not to use journalists as spies many years ago, back in the 70s, that he himself had reserved the right to do so if necessary, and had actually done so once or twice. That just outraged everybody. I mean, I've had people point guns at me and say, spy, spy. I've been interrogated for my CIA connections. I told them that you know, when you say in public that even one journalist spied for the CIA, you endanger every journalist, every single one. And this business with the weapons inspection team being used as cover for spying by the CIA, what is that going to do for the credibility of the United Nations and every United Nations employee out there in the world? There are millions of people around the world who do not understand what a free and independent press is because they've never seen one. They don't have one in their country. In their country, journalists do work for intelligence agencies. And if we're going to try to make them believe that that's not true of us, that we are not spies, we can't be undercut by our own government. That's what they're doing. I mean, I'd like to haul the head of the CIA out there and plunk him down in the boondock someplace with a bunch of armed militiamen and have him convince them he wasn't a spy.
Terry Anderson, he's suing the government of Iran, charging it with sponsoring his captors. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, by Antioch University, a place for writers, on the web at www.antioch.edu or 937-767-6494, and by Random House, publishers of Confucius Lives Next Door, What Living in the East Teaches Us About Living in the West, by T.R. Reid. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Joe Williams, who sang with Count Basie's band.
I never cared much for moonlit skies. I never winked back at fireflies.
Joe Williams died yesterday at the age of 80. Also, we continue our conversation with former hostage Terry Anderson. He's suing the Iranian government, accusing it of sponsoring his kidnappers.
Or candlelight on the mistletoe. But now when you turn the lamp down low, I'm beginning to see the light. Used to ramble through the park, shadow boxing in the dark. Then you came and caused a spark that's a four-alarm fire now. I never made love by lantern shine. I never saw rainbows in my wine. But now that your lips are burning mine, I'm beginning to see the light.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Terry Anderson. He's suing the government of Iran for $100 million in damages, accusing the government of having sponsored the Hezbollah, the Islamic fundamentalist group that held Anderson hostage in Lebanon for nearly 7 years. When he was kidnapped in March 1985, he was the Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press. When you were kidnapped, you had been engaged to Madeleine Basile, who you married after you were released. And I'm wondering what it's been like to try to keep a relationship together when early on in your relationship you spent 6 years in captivity. I mean, that people change in 6 years, and particularly people who are in extreme situations change.
It hasn't always been easy. We've had to do a lot of work. It started when I got out. We had to get to know each other again. We had to build a family around my new daughter, who was 6 and a half when I met her. She was born 3 months after I was taken. We had to deal with the damage. There wasn't any of us who went through that and wasn't damaged in some fashion. I had a lot of problems with communications. I had a lot of problems with, I guess you'd call it my emotional rheostat not working too well. I spent nearly 7 years keeping my mouth shut and trying not to feel things. It was pretty rusty when I got out. And then, we had to go through what any marriage goes through as you get to know each other and as you try to accommodate to each other and adjust to each other. But we've done it successfully. It was a little scary there for a while. We were both, when I first got out, we were both too scared to argue with each other. Somehow it felt like an argument would be a disaster. And it took us a long time to learn that we could argue without, something terrible happening. We're both very strong-minded people, so we had to get used to that.
And you both had to be strong-minded to survive. Here's something else I'm wondering. I think sometimes when you're cut off by somebody who you really love, and I think this might be particularly true when it's early on in a romantic relationship, that distance enables you to kind of idealize the person and to kind of forget what any flaws whatever flaws they have, and to kind of perfect them in your mind. Then when you see them again, you're faced with the reality of a flesh and blood person who has flaws as well as beauties and strengths. And that can sometimes be hard to do, to kind of confront the reality of the person as opposed to this idealized image that you've constructed in your mind. And I'm wondering if you had to go through that with each other.
No, we all had to. All the hostages had that, especially with the families in general. All our loved ones sat here at home polishing our image every day, and making it nice and shiny and rubbing off all the little warts and bumps. And building expectations about what it would be like when we came home, what we would do. And, of course, we sat in our little holes in the ground and built our own expectations about what we wanted to do and how we wanted to live, and they didn't match very well quite often. So, yeah, there were a few rough spots. The problem with Maddie and I was not so much that, but when I came out, I don't know if you remember watching me on television. I see some of the old tapes now, and I look at myself. Boy, I look confident. I was really looking strong.
I was shocked when you came out. You not only look confident, you were so articulate. Oh, but you were so articulate.
I wasn't strong.
You seemed so strong. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem, because here Maddie had been all prepped by the doctors and the psychiatrist to help me, to help me heal, and I didn't look like I was damaged. I was, but I was hiding it. And it took a long time for us to get through that facade where I had to be strong and I had to look like I was fully in control of everything, so that we could get to the parts that were problems and deal with them. That was a real difficulty.
You're teaching journalism at Ohio University. Are your students now too young to have much of a memory of the years of your captivity?
Well, it makes me feel old when these great hulking 20 and 22-year-olds tell me how young they were when they saw me on television. Some of them remember, some of them don't. And it's interesting the way they react. I try to reserve a half an hour, an hour at the end of each course that I teach, and when I can say, okay, I know you've wanted to ask me questions about this all quarter, and I didn't let you because I'm here to teach journalism, but if you want to ask now, go ahead, and I'll tell you what I can, because they're all really curious about it.
What are the main points you want to communicate to your students about journalism and about the risks that journalists have to take?
I'm very passionate about it. I'm sometimes probably too passionate. These young people are not used to passion in their professors. I believe strongly in journalism. I believe that we could not have a free country without a free press. I believe that no country can have a free society without a free, strong, and independent press. I tell them that in my work for the Committee to Protect Journalists, I meet journalists often who go to work every day and not know if they're going to be arrested, jailed, tortured, kidnapped, murdered before the end of the day. It happens to their colleagues. And I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could do that kind of a job. They do it because they know how important it is. They have this absolute need to find and tell the truth. And further, the people who do that to them, the people who arrest them, the people who kidnap them and torture them, they don't do it because they're annoyed. They do it because they know how important it is too. They know that they cannot oppress their people in the face of a free and independent journalism.
One more question. How's your health been? You went through quite a physical ordeal.
Actually, I was in fairly decent health when I came home, except for being very weak. I had no muscles, and I had to do a physical weightlifting program to rebuild my muscles. Lately, I've had a tough run. My horse kicked me in the face and gave me quite a blow, and I've messed up my knee pretty bad. I may have to get a new knee. So it's ironic that I spent all those years in prison and came out reasonably healthy, and this year has been a rough one.
Well, how about the leg and arm that was chained to the wall? Did you get your strength back?
Yeah. I mean, we spent months going to a gym. In fact, I was going to this competition bodybuilders gym with all these huge young men and almost as huge young women. And I would lay down on the bench and grunt and groan at the bare bar, and then some young lady would slap 150 pounds on it, and do 25 presses. And it was a little embarrassing for a while.
Well, at least you had a good excuse.
They were very nice. Yeah, they were very nice, and it worked out after a while.
Well, Terry Anderson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Terry Anderson is suing the government of Iran for $100 million in damages, accusing the country of having sponsored the group that held him hostage in Lebanon for nearly 7 years. Anderson says that if he wins, the Clinton administration is likely to cite national security concerns and waive the requirement that it help collect the settlement. We asked the White House to comment on the case. They referred us to the State Department. A spokesperson for the State Department said they can't comment on Anderson's lawsuit because the case is in litigation. Coming up, we remember singer Joe Williams, who died last night. This is Fresh Air. Singer Joe Williams died last night at the age of 80. He became famous in 1955 when he recorded the blues song Every Day with the Count Basie Band. By the time Williams joined Basie in 1954, he was already a veteran of the big bands, having sung with Coleman Hawkins, Lionel Hampton, Jimmy Noon, Erskine Tate, and Andy Kirk. After leaving Basie in 1961, Williams had a flourishing solo career. And in the 80s, he played Bill Cosby's father-in-law, Grandpa Al, on The Cosby Show. Jazz critic Whitney Balliot once wrote, "Williams is two equally accomplished singers. One is the famous blues singer, and the other is the almost unknown ballad singer." Before we hear an interview with Williams, let's hear a ballad he recorded with Basie in 1956.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. come rain or come shine. High as a mountain and deep as a river, come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you let me. You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me, come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together, and won't it be fine? Days may be cloudy or sunny, we're in or we're out of the money, but I'm with you always. I'm with you rain or shine.
Joe Williams with the Basie Band in 1956. I spoke with Joe Williams in 1989. Chicago must have been a terrific place to get started as a singer, because all the bands would pass through there to play, and a lot of the bands came out of Chicago.
Yeah, they all had to come through Chicago to get the stamp, so to speak. You know.
When you were underage, did you find ways to sneak into the clubs to see the bands?
Yes. I was big, always big for my age anyway. And I was very quiet. And I just wanted to observe. I'd get in a corner someplace and sit down. Club, the owners would come over and sit with me and give me coffee and ice cream and pie and stuff like that, you know. And I'd hear somebody on the stage, and I'd say, oh, gee, I can sing better than that, you know. And they'd say, be quiet and listen, yeah. Which was good advice. Because you learn many things when you listen. Sometimes you learn what not to do as well.
Singing with a lot of different bands in the 1940s, did you find that the singer had a different role in each band? By that I mean, you know, that in some bands the singers were really important, maybe in other bands they were not considered as necessary. And did the musicians, you were saying the musicians were really supportive of you, were they always that way in the
yes.
band? Or did they sometimes feel like the singers took attention away from their own musicianship?
I never felt that. Because if you sing like a musical instrument, for instance, you don't try to cover up your support. You sing with the support. In other words, it's a little bit like a drummer. A drummer is supposed to play, just try not to get in the way, is the expression that was used by one drummer, Sonny Greer, who was with the Ellington Orchestra. And try not to get in the way. That's what a drummer's job is for. The musical swing, if you try not to get in the way, and the same thing with the singer. You don't get in the way. You're the soloist. So you can punctuate, make a statement, but you don't get in the way of the music itself. And it gives everybody a chance to contribute. You mustn't ever have someone back there, have a section back there feeling, my part is not important. My part is important, and if it's done subtly, you know, then I have to make room for it so that it's heard, and heard the way they want it to be heard.
In 1948, I think it was, you had a nervous breakdown.
47.
You spent about a year in the hospital?
Yeah, 47, I think it was, yeah.
What were your symptoms, so to speak? What was going wrong?
Oh, gosh, symptoms now. Well, I didn't want to go out anywhere. I don't think I could get dressed and go out in the street even, you know. Severe depression. And a number of things might have brought it on. But I think it was just trying to decide what I wanted to do, whether I really wanted to do what I was doing or what.
Whether you wanted to sing or not? Or whether you wanted to sing with the bands you were singing with?
Yeah, whether I wanted to sing or what I wanted to do with my life, really. I went into a severe depression because I used to get high every day, of course, you know, and I stopped that just like that. I stopped that like I stopped smoking cigarettes. One day I was smoking, the next day I wasn't.
You getting high on marijuana?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when you had this big crisis and figured out you had to decide which direction you wanted to head in, did you check yourself into the hospital? Or?
Mm. No, my wife put me in the hospital. She checked me into the hospital. And I spent a year in diagnostic. They didn't know what to do with me, really. They had no idea what to do with me, I don't think.
Did you feel like
they
you belonged?
They gave me electric shock and insulin shock. And
electric shock must have been in the really experimental stages in 1947.
Oh, I'm a living experiment.
You must have been terrified when you knew you were going to get electroshock therapy.
When you see the people that have had electric shock, then you can have some apprehension. But when you see the other people who've had the treatment, you can become apprehensive.
But you hadn't seen anyone yet, so you didn't know what it was you were supposed to be worrying about.
Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah. You know, what it,
well, what effect did it have on you?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, it knocks you out, for one thing. So I don't know what might have happened during the times that I was knocked out. I have no idea about that. But eventually it stopped. They stopped it. And I don't know. It's I was busy observing people around me in there, you know, like, wow. Some people who had been there for 25 years and stuff, you know, like that. And I could see how easy that was a trap
that
you could fall into, where the state would take care of you and you eat, you know. Food was good. You know, on Sundays, you go to church. You go to choir rehearsals during the week. And they had an orchestra in there, a symphony orchestra, a concert orchestra, as well as a dance orchestra. And there was, you know, rehearsals and what have you. And I was working with the band there. And it was quite an experience.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with Joe Williams, who died yesterday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Singer Joe Williams died yesterday at the age of 80. We're listening to an excerpt of a 1989 interview. I asked him to talk about how he first joined Count Basie's band on the day after Christmas in 1954. Who had been the singer right before you?
Nobody.
He had not had a singer for a few years?
Yeah, that's right.
What made him decide to take you on?
I don't know. He sent for me to come by his hotel in Chicago, and we talked. And he said, I can't give you much or what you're worth, but I can give you something, and why don't you come with me and see what people all over the country think of your work? And as things get better for me, they'll get better for you. You know? And that's all it was. And so he sent me a money order. That was in September. But a week before Christmas, he sent me a money order telegram, and I booked a flight to LaGuardia from Chicago, from Chicago's Midway, and joined the band. And we got together with arrangers named Frank Foster and Ernie Wilkins. And Ernie made Every Day. Frank Foster made The Comeback and All Right, Okay, You Win, and Every Day I'll Fall in Love All Over Again with You, and most of our things. Teach Me Tonight, Ernie Wilkins made. You know.
Let me ask you about the big hit, the first big hit you had with Basie,
yeah.
Every Day. Was it your idea to record this?
Yeah.
Why did you choose it?
Because I like it.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, he was so funny. Basie said, do you know any of Jimmy's things? You know, Jimmy Rushing, who had been with him in the 30s.
Right.
You know, and the 30s and the 40s, actually, you know. And I said, no, I don't know any. You don't know none of Jimmy's stuff? I said, no. He said, what do you know? Every Day.
Let me play Every Day.
All right.
And this was recorded in 1955. My guest, Joe Williams, and the Count Basie Orchestra.
Every day. Every day I have the blues. Every day I have the blues. Well, you see me worry, baby, because it's you I hate to lose. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Nobody loves me, nobody seems to care. Speaking of bad luck and trouble, well, you know I've had my share. I'm gonna back my third game, moving on down the line.
Your diction's different when you're singing blues and when you're singing, say, a ballad or a pop standard?
Not really, because if you don't understand the words, you can't, you couldn't enjoy it. I remember when I was singing blues someplace, and Harry Sweets Edison was with me at the time, and he would say, make it plain, and explain it to him, explain it, you know.
You never had formal vocal training.
No, not really.
As you get older, do you ever wish that you had formal vocal training that would keep your vocal cords in as good shape as possible, or do you know all that stuff anyways?
Know all what stuff?
About how to sing so that it doesn't hurt your vocal cords.
I guess I know. I don't know.
I mean, your voice is
in
great shape.
I guess I know, yeah. I was wondering why, you know.
Why is she asking me this?
Yeah.
Well, I've just met a lot of singers who didn't have vocal training and who at some point in their career go to a teacher or wish that they had because there's just so much stress that's put on their throat.
Yeah, no, I don't put any stress on me. Stress. I went through all that early. I got rid of all that in 1947. All the stress. Yeah, to do anything that's stressful now, nothing.
Can I ask you one last question?
What?
I noticed you're wearing a Jewish star.
That's on one side. On the other side is St. Genesius.
Oh.
The words guide my career.
Uh-huh. What words are those?
Guide my career.
Oh, guide my career. Oh, okay.
Yeah. My wife gave me that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
She's Jewish, or?
No. We just don't take any chances.
Well, I guess that's a good attitude.
Yeah. No.
Joe Williams recorded in 1989. He died yesterday at the age of 80. Let's close with a great example of his ballad singing. This is the UB Blake, Andy Razaf song, I'd Give a Dollar for a Dime, recorded at the Vine Street Bar and Grill in Hollywood in 1987. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
That little jukebox right over there is like a magic key. For it can take me anywhere on wings of memory. I'd give a dollar for a dime. I've got to hear that record play again. Turn love's December into May again. Bring me the thrill just one more time. I'd give a dollar for a dime. I've got to hear that sweet refrain again that carries me down lover's lane again. Back when the world was all in rhyme, seems that song was written for us. Every word and note has charm. Our two hearts would sing the chorus as I hold you in my arms.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publishers of Robert Thurman's book, Circling the Sacred Mountain, A Spiritual Adventure Through the Himalayas, written with Tad Wise. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the spy controversies surrounding UNSCUM, the UN Special Commission charged with inspecting Iraqi weapons. We talk with former Chief Inspector Scott Ritter. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.